Now, without further ado, we'll get started on it.
I'm in the standard format. I'll give you the Hebrew word first, give you the English, and then give you, I'll give you the English, give you the Hebrew. This test will also have an additional section on the numbers, so this will be a little longer than the other ones. I think you'll endure. So, oh, by the way, I should say for the tape students, I should get close to the microphone here.
For the tape students, several are on tapes, and the copy of this quiz is in the college library in the files there, so just go ahead and pick up a copy of it, and everything's there but the answers.
Okay.
In addition, for our third section here, masculine modifier. In other words, there's forms. In other words, the forms I want you to put down are that first column on the chart, the ones that are for a masculine modifier and for an absolute form rather than construct. Okay.
On the verbs in Hebrew, we can put those English in the infinitive. We can put down the meaning, but you have to put it.
Oh, yeah, you can put infinitive if you want, sure. Dictionary form in English and dictionary form in Hebrew.
not finished and we're not finished.
Okay. We're going to change papers. There'll be 66 points possible on this test.
In addition to the others, it's 2 points each for the first section. It's pretty much all or nothing, which is the English translation. 3 points each for the second section, 1 point each for each spelling error, that includes a letter or a vowel point, half point for dictation. And then there'll be 2 points each for this last section, still the same thing, 1 point per spelling error, but we're only going to count them worth 2 points total. Okay. Somebody else understands this John over here, so don't need to bother. Okay. Number one, rock means only. Number two, ivri, the word for Hebrew, either can be used either adjective or noun. So I just put Hebrew is all I need. King, meaning honest or true, or thus or so. Number four, case means end of something. And madad means to measure. Ma'uma means anything you want. Then emeth is truth. Kulanu means all of us, every one of us, is the suffix form of that. Kanan is to favor or be gracious toward. Get the word grace, chen, from that. The word kana, Hannah's name is involved in that. Then bachan, to test, try, or examine. Questions, anybody, on that? Yes.
On number four, it's an and. Well, it's kind of an and, though.
Okay, that'd be fine. At the end, that would be fine. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I think it's actually in the case, but they got the right idea in there. No mercy there.
Yeah.
One of those things where they took a noun and made another preposition out of it, by putting, preposition in on it and so forth. Okay, now, spelling in these other ones. Nile River, right in here, Yor. This could refer to any river, actually. Yor, Yod, Shua, Aleph, Kolon, Resh. Cow, heifer, Bay with Pathak, Resh with Kamath, Ara. Food, Ochel. I probably should have noted not to write lechem. Did anybody put lechem? Okay, I guess everybody's okay. Ochel.
You want the accent?
Oh, you don't have to have the accent. No. That's not part of the text anyway. So there's no accent to worry about.
The
okay. To be silent, astonished, number four is dam. Dam. Intelligent, discerning, navon, which we hope all of you are today. Navon. Unless, except, or but rather is key in. Two words. He and him. And spy or scout. Let's see if I have space here. Miragel. Name was Shua. Resh was Pathak. Gimel was Dagesh and Seri. And Dagesh is worth 1.5 points. So if they listed Dagesh, it's 1.5 point. Everything else is 1 point.
Is that how Dagesh did that?
Laney?
Is it a
doubling? Yeah, no, it's not a doubling. It's a Begat Kapat letter. See, Gimel's one is a Begat Kapat letter, so apparently it's a. Let's see. It could perhaps be either way in that one. It could be either way.
I didn't remember.
Some of them are ambiguous. And see, if you have a closed syllable before, you can usually figure that it's going to be a lane if it's in a Gagapa. But here it's an open syllable before it, so it could be an actual doubling too. And you might have two dagishas on top of each other. I don't know. Did they give a transliteration of it near the things that will tell you what they, at least they think it is? But sometimes they may not do it. They don't want to commit themselves either. I think they're giving transliteration. Oh, it does?
Yeah.
They give you two? Okay. So they're thinking of it as a... Yeah, that'd probably be the safest guess since it's following the syllable. That would be the main criteria. Okay. Where do we leave off here? Intelligent. Spies guy. Okay. Nose, face, or anger is off. You get the final pay there. Off. To be hungry, ra'ev. We've had ra'av for famine, so just get into it. Ra'ev. And then how or in what manner, ache. And there's a couple of variations on this. You can either have ache or acha. He's looking. So it's an option. Okay, questions on any of these for anyone? All right, going over here to the column, one of the masculine modifier form in the absolute. So first one, three would be shalosha, shawa, lamed, sheen with the shawa and lamed, then another sheen with kamase. Shilosha.
Is there a dagesh in the second
sheen? I don't think so. Isn't
it? Yeah, did you? There were some that had them, but.
They only encourage them.
Number five has one, but. Number six has one. Looks like I copied it wrong.
Yeah, five and six.
Five and six.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I'll assume I copied them down wrong, copied them down correctly here, so if there's any errors, let me know. But I think this is correct.
So it's a half off?
Yeah, half off for a dagesh still. Okay, and there's only two maximum on these. 2 points total. Okay, four. Arva. That's Resh, Shua. Arba'a. This brother had a question about this. That is a dagish lane there, because this we do have a closed syllable, and so that would be just a. Remember when a begad kafat begins a syllable, normally has a dagish lane.
Wrong vowel point, except one.
Yeah, 1 point for each vowel point is wrong. Okay, number five is chamisha. This one has the dagesh machine. Chamisha. Six. Shisha. This also has the dagesh machine. Number seven. Shiva. When you start writing Hebrew and trying to write it fast, you make a good case for the Masoretic being masochist, you know, with all these dots and so forth. Okay, number eight.
What was that? 66 total now, because there's 2 points for each of these. There's eight of them, so there's 16 points possible in this part, 20 points possible in the first section, 30 in the second section, so 66 points possible. So subtract the number of points from 66 and put that toward the top, if you will. Pass it back to the owner. And
the first 10 were worth three?
The first 10 are worth two each. The second 10 are worth three each. And the last eight are worth two each.
On the last one, I'm missing the H is worth how much?
Half point, same in the second section.
If the dog H is on sheen,
in other words,
it's there and shouldn't be.
No.
Oh, the point, all of that, all the difference between the sheen.
Well, if there's
this came up.
I didn't put.
Call a half point on that.
I didn't put it on either one because I just forgot to put it on.
Oh, you just didn't put it on there, period. Just take a half point on that. It's not really a vowel point, so. Okay, once you've satisfied with the correctness of the score, you can pass them to the front and we'll collect them. Don't forget our other vocab quiz, not vocab, but translation quiz this Thursday, right? So you'll be responsible for the reading for the last four chapters, 33 to 36. It'll be from Hebrew to English, of course. Okay. Lesson 37, we left off talking about the Niphal, and we were looking at the four possible translation values of the Niphal to be guided, of course, by the context. I don't remember exactly which my marker got slipped out here, but I think we were talking about that middle meaning, weren't we? Or had we finished that? Does anybody have a mark to indicate that? So we had the incomplete passive. I know we covered that. Then there's the middle, and there was a reflexive and a resultative, and I don't think we'd gotten to those.
I think you just went down to that very last paragraph. You said it all down to
only. Oh, have we gotten down that far?
Well,
okay.
I think I
jumped ahead just to mention that to you.
We haven't covered reflexive.
Right, because I don't think we talked about those. Okay, there was this middle idea where instead of saying he broke the window broke, and you can use the window as the subject of this verb, a Niphal verb. And, of course, it could mean the window was broken or the window broke. The context would have to kind of decide the difference. If you could have an incomplete passive there, too. So this gets real sticky sometimes, deciding which way it should be rendered. But he says, unlike the incomplete passive construction, middle verbs are active in form, but the meaning, that is, in a voice sense, is in a sense reversed. Now, of course, this is the way it comes out in English. In Hebrew, it's just a Niphal form either place. The object of the active verb has become the subject of the middle verb. Niphal verbs in Hebrew often correspond to middle verbs in English. So often, not always, of course, but often. This is one way they could be translated. So you have to kind of be guided by the context. Recognize you've got a Niphal form. Once you see a Niphal form, bear in mind what the options are and see what fits the best. So here, Niftach HaSha'ar, the gate opened. When it's all by itself like that, you could either say the gate opened or the gate was opened. That's a possibility. Or you'll see this resultative idea, the gate was open. So there's a number of possibilities there. And in some instances, the context may not absolutely nail it down. And you may be left with several possibilities there. And you have to be, you know, honest and say that's what it is. You know, it's got several possibilities here. Usually these meanings aren't going to result in a drastic difference semantically, though. I mean, whether the gate was opened or whether the gate is opened or whether the gate is open, whether the gate opened or whether the gate is open, it's all got the same basic meaning. You know the gate's open, you know, and you may or may not be looking at who did it or whatever, you see. It's kind of ending up in the same place. The vessel broke, same kind of thing, and the people gathered, so we talked about that. Now there's a reflexive meaning. Now reflexive means that you're doing something to yourself or someone's doing something to themselves. It's where you're performing an action, you're receiving the benefit of it. This is one of the uses of the reflexive in Greek also, of course. The middle voice in Greek is reflexive. That's one of the meanings of it. We will see an intensive reflexive a little bit later on, the hithpael form, which has this idea of reflexive, but it's got an intensive idea to it also. So this is not an intensive reflexive, but it is a reflexive form, or it can be used that way. So he saw himself in the water, he washed himself, he sold himself into slavery. These are all reflexive types of meanings. He sold himself, or he washed himself, doing something to yourself. Now, nifal verbs often require this translation, again, in context. So we've got nig'al here, he redeemed himself, from the verb ga'al, to redeem, the nifal form here, and in the context, it'd be he redeemed himself, or he sold himself, nimkar. So that one, again, you're going to have to look at context, but consider reflexive idea as one of the options for the middle idea and for the, I shouldn't say middle idea here, but just reflexive idea of the nifal. And then there's a resultative. More important than either of the two preceding categories is the nifal verb in a resultative meaning. Essentially a stative verb, the resultative nifal describes the state of its subject, which has been produced by the verbal action named by the root. So here's another possibility for translating the nifal in a resultative sense. Namely, it's gaining a sort of a stative verb status. You're taking an active verb and you're making it into a stative kind of verb by virtue of describing the object as having arrived at the state of having that action performed. Probably the best thing is to compare these active, passive, and resultative here so you can see the difference. The active here from pathak would be to open. The passive would be niftak, to be opened. To be opened. The book was opened, for example. And then a resultative, the same form, nifal now, niftak. So it's no different in the form in Hebrew, but a possible translation would be to be open. The book was open. Describing its state, the book was in a state of being open. Now, of course, in order to get into that state, it had to be opened by somebody. And if you find the construction making it quite clear that a verbal action was taking place and you're really focusing on the action, you might be translated, the book was opened. But if you're if the context is only pointing to the result of the action, then you might translate it, the book was open. It's a subtle difference, but it is a difference nevertheless, and this is one of the uses of the nifal. Here's another example, shavar, to break. Nishbar, to be broken, and nishbar also to be broken or to be in pieces. Now here, the phrase to be broken comes out the same both in English for resultative and for passive. Because in one case, he talks about it, maybe I'll just read his statement. In English, the equivalent of the resultative is so often formally the same as the passive that the distinction made here is difficult to grasp. In the passive, it was broken. Was is an auxiliary verb in the unit, was broken. In the resultative, it was broken. Was is the verb to be followed by an adjective participle. Does that make any sense to you? In other words, to say to be broken, it was broken. The was could be understood as part of the verb form, as it were, part of the verbal combination, to be broken. Or the was could be taken as a stative verb, and the word broken could be taken as an adjective or participle. And it was broken. In other words, it was in the state of being broken. And the first one, it was broken by somebody. It underwent the verbal action of being broken. The other, it's just, it was in the state of being broken. So it's really kind of the same thing, except sometimes you're looking at the result and sometimes you're looking at the process. And in English, it comes out oftentimes with the very same words, and our intonation patterns or other contextual cues will tell us the difference between those two. Now, he says one can see this difference most clearly by applying, for example, a transformation into present real. If you convert it back into the present rather than the past, sometimes you can make a difference. The passive idea would be, it is being broken. So talking about the present and putting in the present, it is being broken. It's undergoing the process of being broken. Whereas the resultative is, it is broken. It is broken. In other words, it's in the state of being broken right now, and you're not emphasizing the action going on. So this is a very subtle distinction in many respects, especially since the English comes out about the same. But keep in mind this idea of result versus the idea of the process that is accomplishing the result. The nifal can speak of both of those. Very frequently, the resultative stative has the nuance of potentiality. So here's some examples of how that is. The resultative state of idea. Again, these are all under this category of resultative, but they also get the idea of potentiality. Notice this. Ra'a, and then nir'a to the nifal form, means to see, and then to be seen is the passive idea, or to be seeable, visible, or to appear. To be seeable or to be visible. And that could be your stative idea, to be visible. And it is indicating a kind of a potentiality. In other words, it's got the capability of being seen. The capability to be seen, or the potential to be seen, is what we call visible. If you say something is visible, it's capable of being seen. It's got the potential to be seen. So you get that kind of a sense. Yare, to fear, and nor'a, the nifal form, can mean to be feared in a passive sense, or to be fearful, dreadful, or terrible. In other words, to have the potential of being causing fear. So to be fearful, dreadful, or terrible. There's that stated verbal idea. And remember, that's not what it automatically means. It's just that's one of the possible translations of it, depending on the context. Achal, and then ne'echal, to the nifal form, can mean to be eaten or to be edible. To be edible. So if you want to talk about a certain food or something that's edible, a certain thing that's edible, you may use it in a stative sense. Or if you talk about it actually in the process of being eaten, then you'd use the passive sense. Bachar, and then nifal, nifchar, to choose, can mean to be chosen as a passive sense, or to be choice or select or acceptable, a choice person or a select person in that sense, you see, giving that stative idea. Achav, to love, ne'echav, to nifal form, to be loved, or to be lovely or lovable. So you can say that that verb ne'echav could mean he is lovable as well as he is loved. Or he was loved, or he was lovable. Okay, then yashav, becoming no shav in the nifal, means to inhabit in the call form. The nifal would be to be inhabited, or possibly to be habitable, to be habitable, to have the potential or capability of being inhabited. And then matzah, to find, nimsa, to find in the to be found at the nifal, or possibly to be extant or to exist. In other words, to be findable, you know. So that would give the idea of existence. These four categories have been defined on the basis of English. In Hebrew, however, they are one. The medial passive is expressed by nifal form. So really, you see, the Hebrew form is nifal in all of these cases, and it's only got one form. And it's using not only the form, but also context to give a certain nuance of meaning that comes out translated differently in English. So the point is that Hebrew does use the nifal. It has only one form, and in their minds they're only thinking of one thing probably, but to our minds and the way we break it down in English, we have these four different categories. Yes, Tony?
Yeah, crazy question. In their mind it's one form. Is there any way that all four concepts can be locked up in one?
Well, I suppose that there is, in a way, there's a certain concept of nifal that I think, though, that there is really semantically something different going on in these different categories, but it's the problem that we have is we have a difficulty defining nifal independent of all these specific uses. There's a concept of nifal plus the context that is deriving their meaning. So the nifal form is just one form, but we have a very difficult time describing what it is. Medial passive is maybe the best idea. It's a medial passive form. Well, what is a medial passive form? Well, it's you know, these four different categories, you know. So we have to bring it back into the categories to get meaning out of it. For them, they have the nifal form plus context, and they're deriving meaning straight from that without thinking about whether we call it middle or we call it reflexive or this or that.
What I'm wondering is if there's a potential in there work.
At the same time, I think so. I think that that a given passage, especially say between that middle idea and that resultative idea, for example, or even the incomplete passive and the resultative idea, especially those three. The reflexive seems to be pretty straightforward. I mean, you know, you can tell usually from a context where somebody's doing something themselves. But the other three, I think you'd be hard-pressed in some instances to say that it's this one and not this one. It may be a combination of all of those. It's just that it kind of depends on what the verbal thought and the flow of the thought is, the way you're perceiving it at the time. So they may just have a concept of nifal, you know. That's their concept, and then English is being pressed to make delineations and discriminations because of the way we set up our thought patterns. Yes, John?
Do you have anything on that? Okay. I was going to say, in the reflexive, there are certain verses, of course,
Right.
Not take anything.
Exactly. Exactly.
Created itself.
Yeah.
And we know.
Right. For sure. Yeah, there's a certain smaller class of verbs that even be used that way. And that's part of it. You're looking at the meaning of the words and the flow of the thought and using those things. That's what we call context. And that's how we decide
what to...
There are
verbs that are by nature, as we've seen in Greek, reflective, washed.
Sure.
Unless it shows an agent.
Yeah. If you see something like...
Assume anything that it's reflective.
Yeah, things like washed or bathed or something like that are normally going to be, if there's no object stated, they're going to be understood as reflexive, and or this middle reflexive idea. And if there's an object stated, then of course you get more of a middle sense to it, maybe at least in Greek, or just a pure out active sense to it. Okay. Well, that brings us to, there's a couple more comments up here. Yes, Doug? Oh, I think that's just French. Is anybody French experts here? Or
the word of the sensible way is reflective or defined. I find myself in this place.
Oh, yes, okay.
That's the idea. I find myself there and
right. Coming into a state of existence, you know, of being in that position and discovering that, you know.
Yeah, and it's just translated as the
found. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. There's the solution. I knew it was French, but I haven't had French. If it was German or Spanish, I'd probably be all right. Okay. Some Nifal verbs have no kal counterpart. Now we're going to see this with these derived verbs too. There'll be no kal form, period. And sometimes lexicons do it differently. Some of them don't list anything under the kal, and you'll find the form only listed under a Nifal. Some of them will give you a root with no vowel points on it for the kal, and say an unused root or something, and refer you to a Nifal, or then put the Nifal underneath it or something like that. Same is true with PL and so forth. Especially a lot of PL verbs are not found in the kal. So, that's something to watch out for. So here's the verb, you know, nilcham, he fought. Nistar, he hid. Nimlach, or nimlat, he escaped. So forth. These are all nifal forms. You might make this analogous to the Greek deponent verbs, where they have passive forms but have active meaning, and they have no active forms, like ginomai or erkomai or something. For the Greek students, you can see a parallel there. Now, others would appear to be denominative, although this is a rare use of the Nifal pattern. Denominative means basically making a verbal idea out of a noun. In other words, you've got a noun and then you make a verb out of it. Say the noun for profit, taking that and making it a verb out of it. And so that's what we mean by denominative here. So Nibba or Ninibba, to prophesy from Navi. There is some debate about that, though. Sometimes you don't know which comes the first, the chicken or the egg, you know, whether the verb was first and then the noun was derived from that. So there can be some debate about it. But he's saying that it's possible to use a Nifal pattern in a rare instance to make a verb out of a noun. This may be a debatable example. But you'll see this with PLs and other forms, that where they'll take a noun and make a verbal, you know, verb out of it. Or, of course, like I said, it might be the other way around. But there's an association between them. Okay, now, Nifal verb stems and inflection. Now to getting into the forms, how to make these things. The Nifal verb is derived. Question before we get into that?
Well, it's kind of tied between the two of them here.
Mm-hmm.
On this translation over here, in English we can say, take love here.
Uh-huh.
We can say, he will be loved.
Mm-hmm.
Or, he will be lovely. You know, I mean, you can't do that
right
with all of them, of course.
Uh-huh.
But it puts it in a future.
Right.
And here, it's always, that's a past, basically.
Well, remember that we're only looking at perfect forms here. The Nifal perfect. There's the Nifal imperfect. Yeah.
Okay, they don't list.
No, they haven't really said much about it. They're going to get to that here in this next
okay
section. There is a Nifal imperfect also, where you could say he will be loved. Right. So, and its pattern is a little bit less discernible than the perfect. The perfect's got that noon on the front. It's easy to identify. The imperfect basically is going to have a double first radical and some different vowel points. So those you can sometimes trip up on.
So, okay, so when we get into the torrent over here, this is when it's saying imperfect, that's nifal imperfect.
Yeah, nifal imperfect. So it's still got this nifal meaning, passive meaning, but it'd be incomplete action or future. So if you wanted to say he will be loved, you'd use a nifal imperfect.
Is that right?
What's that?
The form is only that, doesn't it?
Well, that's that plus the vowel point change, too. You get the seri, see, instead of a colon. Remember, it said yik tov, it's yikatev. And you also get the pathog, I mean the commas on that first radical. So it's a different pattern.
The
Well, yes, but presumably they added those because that's the way it was pronounced.
But
now we have to take that by faith.
Right. Well, I was wondering, I looked last night in the Nephil imperfect, and it has the same continence as the call.
Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah. If it weren't for vowel points in Dagesh, you couldn't tell the difference. Well, I think there's some justifiable. There would be some justifiable question about it if it involved a theological issue. Some of these other dry verbs are quite different because you've got a prefix or something that involves a letter, and you can tell those unambiguously. But nifal imperfect happens to be one where the letters are just the same as the pl imperfect. I mean, as the call. So, unless you've got Now, I don't know. It's possible that the original manuscripts before the Masoretes put this dagesh for doubling may have put two consonants there. If they put two consonants there, that would unambiguously tell that that was this particular form. So that may be one consideration. I'd have to do some research to find out if there's any evidence for that. We may not even have any manuscripts that we could even check to find out if that's the case. So it may have been that the Masoretes are the ones that made the decision. If they did, then, of course, there is some room for doubt. And they would be making the decision on the basis of the context and what they thought the verb should mean in that context. So I think there's some, it's worthy of consideration there. We'll see the same in some of these other derived verb forms, too, that there's only, the only difference is dog issues and vowel points. Okay. Now, the nifal verb is derived from a triliteral root by the prefixation of a nun. This is, we're talking about the perfect now. And in the imperfect in a certain sense too, but the nun gets assimilated. So in the perfect, the stem has the basic form, niktav, which undergoes no unusual changes in inflection. So here's your basic pattern for the perfect, niktav, from kathav becomes niktav. And you're adding a nun to the front and dropping the comets off the first letter and turning it to shwa, so you get a closed syllable on the front. And then the rest of it's the same. The imperfect was originally of the form yan kativ, which with the assimilation of the nun became yikatev. Now that may be debatable, but we do know that this is what it ended up being. And what he's thinking of is that there was a nun that was there that was assimilated. That accounts for the dagesh. Now we have seen nuns assimilated before, so that's not unusual. That's certainly a possibility. But the form that you have is yikatev. Notice the dagesh and the kaf. And then the pattern, the vowel pattern, hirik, comets, seri, yikatev. The imperative and the infinitive construct are based on the same stem as the perfect, as the imperfect, where the doubling of the first root consonant is the most striking characteristic of the type in general. The participle and infinitive absolute are based on the perfect. Well, let's look at the examples here of the roots of these various types. First, a regular form, katav, becomes niktav in the perfect, yikatev in the imperfect, imperative hikatev. So we're going to see this tendency now for imperatives to have, when you have a prefixed element, imperatives are going to get a hey. We'll see this in other verb forms. So hikatev, it's just exactly the same as yikatev, except you take the yod off and put a hey on. The vowel pattern is the same for the imperative. Of course, there are some other derived forms too. Then infinitive construct down there, hikatev, that's exactly the same form as the imperative, no difference. And then the participle, niktav, that's exactly the same as the perfect form. So that's, of course, going to run into some ambiguity sometimes as well. Now, a three guttural, right under that, the second line, nishlach in the perfect, and then yishalach. Now, that is pretty much the same as the strong verb, except that you have a pathok type imperfect rather than the tseri type, as it were. In other words, the last vowel is going to be a pathok now. And hishalak, imperative, and hishalak for the infinitive construct, and then the participle nishlak with a comets there instead of the pathok. So the participle is different in the perfect than the perfect form. It's got a longer vowel there. Then a one guttural, ne'eman, you get segols there, and a segol and a chatef segol for your preformatives. And so instead of, you see, the problem is that with the one guttural, if you've got a guttural in the first position, it can't take shwa, so it has to have one of the reduced forms, and the question is which one's going to be. It turns out to be a segol, and then the syllable for it takes a segol as well. Then in the imperfect, you get, I think what they're thinking of here, and he mentions this, is think of it as a compensatory lengthening. Remember, you're trying to put a dagesh in that first guttural. See, the guttural couldn't take shwa, that messes you up. Now it can't take dagesh, so it messes you up again. So instead of taking the dagesh, it gets compensatory lengthening, and the segol gets lengthened to tseri. And then you get a comments for who knows why on the aleph, and then you get your tseri pattern there at the end. So it becomes yeh amin. Then the imperative, once you've got that, the imperative's not so bad, hey amin, and the infinitive construct, hey amin, and then the participle, ne'eman, goes back to the same form as the one guttural except for the lengthening commas in the last syllable. Okay, he'll make some notes about it now, remarks. A, the only deviation from the regular pattern with roots 3 guttural is the replacement of seri with pathak in the imperfect and related forms. We discussed that. B, with roots 1 guttural, including aleph, the perfect usually has the pattern ne'eman, with segol in the preformative and chatef segol after the guttural. In the imperfect and related forms, the doubling of the first root consonant is replaced by a compensatory lengthening of the prefix vowel herek to tseri, and this tseri is unaltered in inflection. So we discussed that, compensatory lengthening to tseri. Then C, the participle differs from the stem of the perfect only in the length of the stem vowel. So looking at all these participle forms, you have a pathak, I mean comments in the last syllable, rather than the pathak. Again, I don't know if I pointed that out with the strong verb or not, but it's true of all of those. They've all got a comments there instead of a pathak. So there is a distinction between those forms. Now, as an adjective, the participle retains this vowel in inflection. And so you're going to keep that comments there. It's not going to shorten like you might expect it to. For example, you get niktava, instead of niktava. See, in niktava, you get the shortening of that. The normal verb form has the shortening, but the participle form keeps the comments there under the top. Doesn't shorten, doesn't reduce. So niktava, niktavim, niktavo, if you see, all of them would keep that comments. Okay, well, that leads us to the total paradigms now, and of course we're not dealing with all the possible ramifications. We're dealing with the regular, the 3 guttural, and the 1 guttural. And these are usually the easiest ones of the irregularities, so kind of a hint is what's coming. Remember, too, that we're striving for recognition here, not trying to memorize all of these little details. And but for test purposes later on, once we get through these derived verbs, we'll probably have a quiz on the strong verb, just the strong verb in these various conjugations, rather not trying to have you memorize all the weak verbs, but just the strong verb. So you've got the basic pattern down, and then you can recognize the pattern usually when you see the weak forms. Okay, so the full paradigm then for your regular verb, in the perfect, once you get this basic stem change, then the endings are just like what you've had before. So that's one nice thing. You're not going to have to learn a new set of endings. So you've got niktav, and then niktava, niktavta, niktavt, niktavti, niktavu, niktavtem, niktavten, niktavnu. So you can almost, once you see that first pattern, you can fill out the rest of it. It's the same as what you had before as far as the endings are concerned. And then for the imperfect, it's somewhat similar. The same prefixes and so forth are there. Of course, we've got some different vowel points, but the prefixes and suffixes are the same that you've had before. So you've got yikathev, tikathev, tikathavi, ekathev, and yikathavu, tikathavna, tikathavu, tikathavna, and nikathev. So it just takes a matter of, making some modifications to the pattern. But the endings, the suffixes, and the prefixes are the same you've had before. And once you see what the basic vowel pattern does, it's pretty straightforward. Imperative, hikathav, and then hikathavi, Remember that hirikyoth for the second person masculine singular, and excuse me, for the feminine singular, and then hikathavu and hikathavna for the plurals. Infinitive construct, hikathav, and then with suffixes, it's going to be hikathavi, hikathavka, so forth. So that's fairly straightforward, although you need to kind of know about that sagol that comes in. And infinitive absolute, there's two forms for the infinitive absolute. We'll have to stop here, we're out of time, but we'll talk about the rest of the paradigm tomorrow. And no formal assignment for tomorrow. If you wanted to do those first few that I mentioned to you, we'll probably go through the first few of them up to the reading in class, if we've got the time. And I think we will. But don't forget that major assignment is the test on Thursday. Okay. So be it. Amen, amen.
What's that?
Just
the first, the sections of the exercises up to the reading. Probably won't do the reading part, you know, but all the other ones will probably come through.
You writing part?
Yeah, I think so. I think I may go through them. If you want to work on it, fine. If not, we'll just do the class together the next time.
So that I don't want to add to your workload. I would rather you prepare, you know, study for the test than do this. So, but if you'd like to, we'll probably go through them. I don't want to get too slow down here in class either, so.